Are we good?
Yeah.
Perfect. All right, so I'll get started. So I'm going to try to keep you awake. I'm going to try to keep it to a half an hour, which is really hard for me. And what I wanted to talk about was this humanistic design approach to data. So we'll talk a little bit about gray meta at the end and give you a peek of what we're doing and how we're doing it. But for me, I'm outside the industry. I don't come from M&E. I spent many, many years at Intuit building financial services platforms and data platforms and a little bit of machine learning back in the days when it wasn't something you could actually get 100 people to come to 10. And moved on to some human capital management company, a little small company called ADP, and quickly jumped into gray meta when I saw what they were doing. And the thing that stood out to me is the data. So I didn't realize this, over 2 exabytes of data a day are being added to the world, which is insane. It's absolutely insane. Most of it is unstructured. I mean, they talked a little bit about unstructured data, but the neural networks out there, it's going to be the number one volume of data we have probably in the next 5 to 10 years. The structure side of data is going away and it's going away really fast. What's interesting about that is it's siloed because we built data up over years. And they're in databases, they're in object stores, they're in file systems, and to move them is incredibly expensive. They lack any context. And so the only context is the context that was generally added by people. And at the time, people couldn't think about what the context would mean or why it would be useful. So much of it is missing context. And ironically, a lot of the relational database has no relation. You don't know what the relation is. You have massive amounts of data. Or the relation is irrelevant at this point. It was relevant 10 years ago, it's not anymore. So what happens is people can't use it. And I've learned, I've just been a couple months here with government, I've learned people have all these assets and files and objects and nobody knows what they are and they can't use them, which is what we're focused on as a company. Where it gets really interesting for me is it's starting to grow. So in M&E, it's files, everything is files and videos. But now we're talking to folks, in fact, Al is one of them, where we want billing data, and we want invoices, and we want the hourlies. Who got paid on this project that's attached to this film? How much did we pay for this particular shot that was over in Bolivia? That it took 4 days. What was our cost on that relative to the time we have from an asset perspective? All interesting things. So focusing on data that's coming in through email, everything is an email, text, social. The platforms are growing at a pace where, honestly, the people can't keep up. And so what you're seeing is this convergence of a little bit of structured data, a lot of unstructured data, and this merging of AI, machine learning, and people don't know what to do. You saw a little bit of that out in the bigger session. What do we do now? Because we have machines thinking for us. The problem is the machines can't think far enough. And you heard, I think the data I heard was 2025. In 2025, this is going to be amazing. Well, we're in 2016. And so the way I think about this is enabling the machines to empower the people and make the data relevant for the users and drive a humanistic approach to design and products and frankly, even in APIs. So people can understand it, consume it, and get what's most relevant. So going a little bit backwards here, I don't know if anybody knows the story on a container. Container was thought up in 1920. Some truck driver who was literally driving produce and goods up into a big ship, and it was 6-7 weeks to load a ship. It's like, there's gotta be a better way to do this. In 1920, he came up with the idea of a metal rectangle box. In 1956-ish or so was when they actually got production, almost 30 years. 30 years from idea to production. What's most interesting about this is in 1 year, shipping costs went from $6 a ton-ish to about 16 cents a ton overnight. It disrupted the entire industry. You had people that had to load carts and trucks and drive them in the boats. You didn't need them anymore. People didn't go away, by the way. The people evolved, the jobs evolved. They learned how to deal with the innovation of a container. By the way, the container is still the number one way we ship goods today. So what has it been, 70 years later, something like that? It's still the number one way we ship goods. It changed the entire world. Shipping became faster. Goods were higher quality and got there on time. We shipped across the world where things used to be contained by regions. Very, very innovative and very, very disruptive at the same time. And data is doing the same thing right now. I love this slide because I came from the days of hard drives, and I joked with Tim the other day, our kids aren't going to have a concept of storage. I still get annoyed when my phone where it says, please delete something because you're out of storage on my iPhone. And I just got the new one. I'm like, I actually have a device where I'll never have that problem. Kids don't understand this. 128 meg to 512 gig on the size of your fingernail. And that's astonishing. Why that's important is going to change behavior. It's also going to change the ability and availability of data. Again, our generation, one layer below, not my generation of kids, and the millennials, don't think about this stuff. They really don't. And when you build products and you're having them look at data and look at the graphs, I saw the graphs out, I'm going to pick on them a little bit out in the middle auditorium. I saw those graphs. You're not going to find a single millennial that's going to come into your office and understand a graph of data like that. They're going to look at you like you're crazy. And spreadsheets, not something they're going to be able to live with. You can't produce data like that with the millennial generation. You won't be able to find a workforce. So what do? I call it reimagining the experience. This isn't my words, I didn't make this up. This is something that's been out in the technology world for years. But this humanistic approach, it has to be simple. And I think of it as never-ending data, intuitive workflows, and API-enabled. When we build APIs at Grave Meta, we test them with engineers. We don't just assume we're going to build an API and it's going to work. We want to make sure the engineers can use it. We want to make sure it's easy. So when you use an API, it's no guide, there's no help. You understand intuitively what the data is and what the data means. From an actual user experience, it needs to be progressive. You have to realize, and I'll talk about millennials a lot today, millennials don't have the patience. They just don't have the patience. And I'll show you some screens at the end here of how to apply this. If you give them everything, they will literally walk away. I've done user testing where they will just get up and leave because they can't digest it. Their attention span is this big. They're so used to this social thing where it's on all the time. Give me what's most important. Give it to me in three words or less, and I'll figure it out. That's the generation you're going to have to deal with. I think the number I saw last week was almost 60% of the workforce will be millennials by the end of next year. 60%. It's 90 million people hitting the workforce over the next decade. It has to be responsive. Responsive for me is not simply stretching a screen, but you have to be able to think about what's intended, display it in a way that makes sense to the user, whether it's on a phone, a tablet, in the car. Cars now have more data than your phones in some cases, so you have to think through that as you're designing software and displaying data. And then emotional. And so I really get to this side because you have to put it in a place, in a way, in a product where people actually enjoy using it. When you think about data and you think about wanting to drive an experience and drive monetization through data, the best way to get there is to make people love the product and the way they consume it. And if they love it, and I use this example all the time. When somebody completes a task, instead of just closing the screen, push a smiley face to them. And I've done this 100 times. You press a smiley face and they start laughing when they're done with their task. They literally smile. But they're happy and they actually had a good time crunching data and numbers on a graph. That's pretty amazing. It has to be confident. They have to trust that the machine learning is right. If they don't trust it, they're never going to use it. So you have to have that in your product. It gets to the progressive disclosure. Give them what they need so they can make a decision, and then give them more if they need it to get comfortable, because you are talking about transitioning people from a world of people doing everything to people working with machines, and they're very uncomfortable with that. At the end of the day, if you can do this, and I've done this in prior jobs, you'll have a great product. People will use it, people will start adapting technology, and you'll drive efficiency in your business. It's all about driving efficiency and getting it done faster. So how do you do it? This is where everybody fails, me included, actually quite a few times. You don't start at the end, you start in the beginning, you start building things before you actually know what the end result is. So you really have to get to the end, which is the user. What are they trying to accomplish? Understand what they're trying to do. Don't just solve a data problem because there's a data problem. Solve a data problem that's gonna get to an outcome that's gonna drive efficiency. It's gonna drive a higher retention in your employee. Do it because you're going to get a monetization of something that you couldn't get to before, because prior it took 150 people to do it, and now you can do it with only three with technology. But get to that result. The easiest way to get there is honestly just go talk to your team. If you have people that are in production, go sit with them for a couple of days and understand what they care about, what they do every day. It's not all about the work. this is a great example. I created this probably 2 years ago, this Paula Peterson persona. She's, you know, a mature woman. Everybody assumes she hates technology. Her phone's her favorite device. She actually loves technology. But people assume she's afraid of it. People make assumptions about people in the workforce that necessarily aren't true. In fact, most millennials are influencing the boomers that are still in the workforce, and they're changing the perception of technology dramatically over the last few years. They want everything automated. Again, a lot of people fear that people don't want automation because it's going to take their job. Again, they talked about it out there in the main auditorium. People are resisting technology. When I talk to people on the ground, they actually want the automation. They feel like they could be doing more valuable work and getting more things done, and we just don't enable them to do that. We have an incredible opportunity with AI and cognitive services to bring context to data that they've never had before that will enable them to make decisions. We're still going to have humans making decisions. You can't change that. You just have to put it in a framing and in a way, in a workflow that makes sense and it's easy for them to consume. And then you have to close the loop. What does this mean? For me, this is really critical. What do they do? What's the emotion? When you sit and watch someone do their job and you see them cringing their nose and getting frustrated when they're looking at the screen, it's a trigger. There's an opportunity for me to solve that problem. I believe there's an opportunity for data to solve that problem. There's so much data that we have that we can enable to inform them, get them unstuck, if you will. It's going to be critical that you do that. And then focus on those experiences. Too many people want to boil the ocean. You can't fix this. It's not something where you can sit in a room with a great project team and outsource $10 million to, no offense, to Microsoft and say, we're going to solve it for you. It's going to take 5 years. Well, nothing really gets done in 5 years. By the time you're done, it's actually done and it's changed and it's evolved. So be very, very narrowly focused on those things where you can make the biggest impact. Don't try to change the world. Try to change a single point in time and experience, and do that with data. What you'll find is data is critical because data has information that will allow them to get to a decision. It could be, in our world, I'm looking for a scene where it's raining. And that sounds really silly, but I've literally watched people pull archives and they're scrolling through video and hours of video and it's sunshine the entire time. Machine learning can get to that rain within seconds. I'm looking for a particular base, I'm looking for a particular time, I'm looking for a particular altitude in a mountain range. The machine can figure that out for us right now. They can't tell you everything, and they're gonna get it wrong probably 40% of the time, but 60% out of 40 is pretty darn good. If you can get me 60% efficiency in what I'm doing, and I still have to be involved at 40%, that's a great outcome. And then you have to measure it. This is the other thing everybody forgets. They implement something, they change something, and they never follow up and actually measure. And again, it was a great session out there. They talked about measuring and being able to measure results. You have to be able to measure results with your data. So the worst thing you can do is implement a solution and then not be able to say, did I get to the outcome? Did I get better monetization of my assets? Did I improve efficiency? Was I able to take these seven people that used to be tagging metadata all day long and move them onto something that's more meaningful, more valuable for my business? Those are the things you need to look at. And you have to track it. You have to track it methodically. It's not something you just do once every year, once every quarter. You do it every single month and measure it just like you would your normal business KPIs. All right. I'm zipping through this. This is crazy. So, examples. This is how we've applied it. And so, full disclosure, we're about 4 months in. On this, so I'm here, has it been 4 months? 4 months. So I kicked in about 4 months ago and took Tim's platform and idea and brought this approach into that platform and idea. And so some examples here. Adding a user to a system. This is something that is probably the number one barrier to any product adoption. You bring a new employee on, you gotta get into the production workforce. There are 17 systems they need access to, and you literally spend sometimes weeks getting them added to all the systems. What's interesting, as we actually interviewed people and did some usability testing, the managers have no idea what all those permissions are. They literally don't. They're going through systems, they have guides, and they're looking at everything. There are 17 fields, which one should I check? I don't know. And they put it off. They literally will put it off and not do it. What we found is They actually know what an administrator is, they know what a producer is, they know what an editor is, and all they know is Adam needs to be just like Leela. And we created this workflow where you literally just drag and drop Adam into Leela's picture and he gets all the permissions are set, two clicks and he's added to the system and ready to go. That's a great use of data. No one's reviewing Leela's data. Now in the experience you can, if you're not sure and you want to look at all the permissions, you can actually pull it up, that progressive disclosure, and understand what does Leela actually have access to and modify that if you want to, but 90% of the time, he's an editor, she's an editor, it's the same thing. I'm just gonna add him to the project. Just that little thing probably saves 3 to 4 days and probably several hours of time for someone. And by the way, the manager is so much happier to use this product, and you're gonna get so much productivity out of that manager as well as Adam, because he's gonna start his job on time, if not way ahead of time based on what they used to be doing there. We get into the MetaFarm platform here. And this is going to cut up on the screen a little bit, so it's going to be hard to see it. One of the things we have in the product today, and this is our next release coming out in November, one of the things we have is search. And giving somebody Google search just isn't good enough. And I joke with Tim about this all the time. If Google's our bar, we have to set the bar a little differently. Because I've yet to actually search anything on Google and get any great results. I spend literally half an hour to an hour looking for the right result. And so we started testing some concepts, and what we realized is there's really not that much categories of what people are trying to find. They want to find something that's 4K or 1080p. They want to look at, that's a saturation over here. I think it's a saturation. I don't know what bit rate is, by the way, but it does say bit rate and frame size. And so there's basic categories. 90% of what they're looking for are going to fall into these basic categories. Most people are searching for the same thing on most days. If you got somebody working in production or someone working in sound, they're looking for similar things. Being able to create your search profile and search on it in a simple, easy way was critical for that group. It narrows down the results to a very, very specific set of results for them. This is big. This is big because they spend hours looking for things today, and there's no easy way to do it. What's interesting is we didn't reinvent this. If anybody's used Amazon, it probably looks really familiar. Amazon spent a lot of time perfecting this search and filtering in their store. And so we didn't copy it per se, but there was some humanistic approach to Amazon's thinking around their search, and we leveraged that. At the end of the day, we realized also, this is a group that's used to timeline view. We had this metadata, and we had literally just lists of metadata, and people weren't making sense of it. And we realized they're naturally inclined to go to this view, so we put it in the timeline view. We allow them to see the frames as they go, which is what they're used to doing. We also, and again, it's cut off here, so it's going to be really hard for you to see this. Below is a list of people. So the same folks you saw up here, they're all working on this project. And the same thing, I saw, and I can't remember the client right now, but I remember literally you had 7 people working on a project. They were finding files, they were packaging them up in the zip, they were emailing them to their friend that was two like doors down in the room, and they were emailing everything around. So we created this concept where I can just invite them to the project, or the file, or even the frame. I can communicate, write in what they're doing, understand what they're doing. It timelines it just like the video is timeline, because again, that's how they do it. We're not trying to change all their behaviors, we're trying to change some of them. But if they're comfortable with this, let them live in that world. And that's the message there. Understand what they're comfortable doing. Understand what's important to them and design around that versus trying to just break the mold every time for breaking the mold. Technology is great. It'll force you down those tunnels where you make bad decisions because technology can, not because it necessarily should. And with AI and cognitive services, it's a big part of what's happening is we're doing things because we can, not necessarily because we should. So it takes a bit of discipline as you're designing and thinking through your products and how you use those products and technologies going forward. All right, so things to remember. My top 5 list-ish. Hire from outside your walls. I'm a big believer in this. It's one of the reasons I came to Grey Meta. It was interesting. I've never been in media and entertainment. This felt like a cool thing to do. Somewhat relevant because of data, but bring some people in that don't know media and entertainment into your group. They will bring a perspective you couldn't have imagined. And you'll start thinking differently about how you do things, how your processes work, with the way you should do things. Involve your ground level. I've gone on a lot of calls in the last six weeks, and I always wonder where's the actual person that's going to be using our software. Those are the people that matter to me. A lot of organizations make decisions at the top and then push it down. You really need to involve that ground level as you're evaluating solutions from people like ourselves, and make sure it's a good fit. Make sure it's something they can use. You'll be surprised how many things will come back with it. It'll surprise you that you wouldn't have thought. Don't wait for perfection. Perfection will never come, ever. You also have to realize that the new generation of people, not just millennials, they don't want perfection, honestly. They just want progress. And so the days of 100% perfect code and never crashing, those aren't necessarily as important. Even I talk about the banks. Like 20 years ago, I was in financial services, and we spent billions of dollars on security because if we ever got hacked, the business was done. Banks are getting hacked like every other week lately, and nobody seems to care. I mean, that's just it's a tone of the culture. They're going to be okay if it falls down a little bit. And you got to react, you have to respond, and you have to deliver value incrementally and fast, but they'll be okay. Measure often. We talked about this. Don't underestimate the significance of a small change. And I always reference Tesla here because I think they're phenomenal with this. These guys are launching a car, and just by the sheer fact that it's electric and it's got this big screen, the first couple of months you're just blown away, right? And it's a rocket ship. But then they come back and they're like, wait a minute, we can make this better. And there's little things they do, and all of a sudden it tells me, hey, it's 7 o'clock in the morning, you're probably going to work, I didn't plug in any navigation, we noticed traffic's pretty crappy from your house to the office today, would you like us to reroute you? Never touched navigation, never entered anything. They know, based on my driving patterns, where I'm going at 7 o'clock in the morning. Little things, the garage, you know, you don't press the button in the Tesla open the garage anymore. It knows when you're within 200 feet of your door and it opens the garage for you. It knows to close it when you leave. Intelligent data, it's all data driven, by the way. That's how metadata and data will drive experiences. No human involved there. You know what, it misses the garage every once in a while. I'm driving away and the garage is still open, but it's 90% good, and I'll take the 90%. The other thing that they do with the autopilot is, you know, they're bridging that technology, and they're bridging it quickly. I mean, they've done 17 releases on autopilot since they launched it, and it gets better every time. Every single time. That's what you need to strive for. And that's what the data can do. The data can allow you to get better. And the reason it can is because as you use data, you learn more about the data. And the more you use it, the more you learn, the better you get. And that's kind of the cycle. And then focus on value versus feature. So with value, you're going to get big wins. And if you get out of the feature trap, and this is something I preach all the time to our team, it's not about the number of features, it's about the value you can deliver. And data is that empowering factor. It actually has all the value. And so if you think about all the problems, you think about your opportunities, and then apply the data lens on top of it, how can we leverage our data to get to that decision and get to a better place in that problem, you're going to be really, really good. If you start building features and trying to find problems for a feature, you're going to find yourself, honestly, in the conundrum that probably 80% of the software companies have right now, and they're building features that nobody wants to use. And I it's terrible. I mean, it's one of those things where you kind of want to go backwards in time sometimes and fix it and kind of go back to where it was. And there's a lot of really good examples where software's gone bad that used to be great products. And so, again, data can help you solve that. So quick 30 minutes. My general perspective is, with our role in Grey Meta, we're going to bridge the gap of AI, machine learning, cognitive services, all the legacy data, marry those two together, and bring it into a workflow in a way that's consumable by humans. And I am with the guy out here. I think we're 2025 before it gets really interesting with machine learning. I do disagree. I think machines will eventually take over and that change will be complete. My wife is like, she hates it when I talk about this stuff because I think it's real though. I mean, today machines are making decisions, they're operating on people. And I don't think my kids will ever drive a car. I mean, I think that's real. So just understand the data, think about it with passion, and then really think about your team's flow and how you empower them with the data. If you guys can do those three things, you'll be great. All right. We have time for questions. Awesome. I love no questions.
Rob, you have a question?
I don't, actually. Thank you, Josh.
So I hope it was helpful. If there are questions, email simple, john@graymeta.com. Happy to chat. If you want to go deeper on our product, too, obviously we're happy to chat about that as well. But again, I think you guys have a huge opportunity in this space. Being new to this space, I see huge potential to maximize the data, monetize the data, and generally just improve the workflow and the experiences for your teams below. All right, awesome.
Great question.
Yeah.
Okay, so you early on you said about driving efficiency and effectiveness. How do you measure? And I understand the concept. So as we're getting that data and we're uncovering, how to use it. Where is GrayMeta? What's that quantifiable number that we can say, hey, we're going to be saving you X amount based on a specific scenario? I'm just trying to wrap my brain around it.
It's really hard. It's really hard, and so it depends on the situation. I think there are situations where, simple situations where the content, mm-hmm. where you're getting to 2 or 3% of your content, and you have libraries of content over decades that now are actually relevant, and people actually may want to watch. One of the use cases we've had is social trending, pushing OTT content based on social trending. Can we find things in MetaFarm based on social trends, push them to OTT in relatively real time, and monetize that? And the answer is yes. And so there's a real simple case where you're going to measure based on monetization, number of things consumed over OTT based on social trends, and then the model, and that model is simple. More complex stuff is, are you really getting value for all the data that you're storing? What are you actually getting from that? Are you getting better quality? Are you getting a return? That's harder to do depending on your business. Like, again, OTT, I picked the easy one. The other stuff is harder. I think sports is another interesting space where you have so many assets and there's so many people that are interested in sports. And I use, again, Tim, I pick on Tim a little bit. If you could let Tim find the Giants game where a guy hit a home run and broke the glass of a boat in the lake that was wider than the ocean that was watching the game, and he'd pay $1 to get that clip and show it to somebody at dinner, I guarantee you would. And those are some of the things where hard to quantify, but I believe it's a real opportunity. The key part, though, Christine, is measuring once you do it. Right. I don't think you'll ever find the perfect measurement. What you should do is actually do it and create the measurement as you go, because you'll never know for sure, right? And again, the data will tell the story on measurement too. You actually start getting data in, you'll understand what the measurement should be.
So John, we're eventually going to approach a point where we store everything and have no idea why we're storing it.
That's today.
Yeah. I don't disagree, it's only going to get worse.
Yeah.
So do you think your measurement techniques will allow users to put parameters around this and say there is no reason to keep this particular piece of data any longer?
I think it already does a little bit. So in our use case specifically, we're finding that a lot of our customers have 75 copies of the same thing. That's the baseline, right?
Yeah.
Baseline, so duplicates, let's get them out of there. From a do you get rid of it perspective, I don't know. I mean, we're in an age of keep it forever. We really are, and data is value. And so my general gut would say for the next decade or two, you probably do want to store everything. And Microsoft's probably happy about that, but I think it's real. I mean, because it's cheap. I mean, honest to God, it is cheap. So it's not a cost thing anymore. 10 years ago, it was a cost thing. Today, it's just a I don't know what I have thing, which is honestly plugging the product a bit. That's where we come in. And we patented this thing called DNA, which essentially is the DNA of your file and object stores. So when you do get to this place where you have 150 petabytes up in the cloud, you know what it is. You know exactly what it is, and you know exactly how you can use it and where you should use it and why you should use it. So I think the simple answer is you'll probably never throw it away. We just have to get better at how we think about it. in an unstructured way, which is key. The structure is disappearing.
But there's also plenty of opportunity to take advantage of technology. You don't have to have human decision making around that data storage, because the technology can tell you what's hot and what's cold and what it's being used for. So
yes.
take advantage of the technology to put your cold data where it belongs and keep your hot data up where the users need it.
There's a lot of folks that are just assuming that cold goes away in the next decade or so.
You've got to test that.
Yeah.
You have to constantly test what's in there.
Okay. Yeah. It's crazy. But again, remember, my kids won't have any concept of storage. I really don't. It'll just be there. Everything will be there.
Okay,
I'm done. All right. Well, thanks so much.